Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan, where today I'll be treading the boards with the theatre critic for The Times, Dominic Maxwell. We'll be discussing the winners of this year's Tony Awards, which took place last Sunday. Did anyone beat Hamilton? And we'll be rounding up three shows currently on in London, from Terence Rattigan to The Titanic. All that coming up on the Monocle Arts Review. Dominic Maxwell, welcome to the show. Now, last Sunday saw one of the biggest events in the theatre world's calendar, the annual Tony Awards. After the nominations, it looked like nobody was getting a look in unless they were part of the Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton. The musical took home a whopping 11 out of 16 of its nominated awards. Dominic, who managed to sneak in alongside?
Well, there were some categories it wasn't eligible for, of course. So, The Humans, a play that's played in New York, I haven't seen, I'm afraid. That won the best play. Musical revival, Colour Purple. Play revival, something that has played in London. The wonderful A View from the Bridge, Ivo van Hove's, I don't know, how do you call it, modernist reworking of Arthur Miller's play. And that also won him Best Director. Jessica Lange won Best Actress for Long Day's Journey and Tonight. And Frank Langella, another play that's been on in Britain as well. Frank Langella won for Best Actor for The Father, which also won Kenneth Cranham Best Actor in The Oliviers. So if you've seen the play, you'll know that is a mighty role. And not to say that anyone could do it, but no great surprise that he won for that in America.
Just as far as award ceremonies go, it's always interesting when something manages to sweep all of the nominations. It's a lot of the nominations, as Hamilton, of course, did. Does that sort of lead to something of a anti-climax, though? Just having one winner across so many different categories, did it make the award ceremony itself feel a little bit like a wet blanket?
No, I don't think so. I think with Hamilton, there's nothing else that would have made sense to win as many as that. I mean, Hamilton is a game changer. You know, it is one of those plays. It comes along once a decade, something like that. So I think, it had to be honoured like it was.
Well, that's good news for Hamilton, at least. Let's bring things back to London now, Dominic, and more specifically, we're going to the National Theatre for a production of Terence Rattigan's The Deep Blue Sea. This is one of Rattigan's most famous texts, but for those unfamiliar with it, let's recap the plot a little bit.
It's about a woman, Hester, who leaves her middle-aged, rich, successful judge husband to go to live in a bedsit in Ladbroke Grove with a faded former fighter pilot called Freddy. And really,
sounds a bit squished.
Yeah, you say that. It's not remotely squished on the Littleton stage. I mean, this is one of those cases where the bedsit is the size of a tennis court, but there's no getting around that on the Littleton stage, and maybe that takes something away from it. It's a remarkable play. It's Rattigan. Rattigan's a great, great craftsman. This is probably his masterpiece. It's a play about sex, partly. It's a play about a woman who has a happy marriage or a happy enough marriage, who falls in lust with this unsuitable young man and junks it all in for him. And the play begins and almost ends with a suicide attempt as she realises, well, as we know and we can see that she's chosen the wrong man, but there's no getting out of it. There's no going back for some reason. Well, not for some reason, but there is no going back to the very decent, very nice husband she left.
From what I understand, the play is famed for its somewhat complicated and flawed female lead. Mm. She's played here by Helen McCrory. What's your verdict on her?
Well, going back to that point about the Littleton and how huge it is, it's not often you sit in the Littleton, about 900-seater, huge, wide stage, and you feel like you're eavesdropping on what's going on. And you do with Helen McCrory here. She gave a much bigger performance as Medea a couple of years ago. But here she's very muted, but the range is huge again. And when she needs to, she absolutely breaks your heart. It's an extraordinary performance. And actually, opposite her as the fighter pilot, Tom Chambers gives in its way, I think, almost as good a performance. You believe in these characters. And the 60 years, because there's a slight sort of middle-class clipped element to it, and that can be a barrier sometimes. that doesn't feel like is it at all here. It feels like people we could know.
Now, she has previously worked with the director in Medea. Do you think that you're sensing some sort of magical connection between the two?
Good question. I'm not sure, because those are both great texts, great parts, and Carrie Cracknell is a terrific director. I mean, this is less radical, and I don't say that as a criticism at all, or as praise, actually. This is less radical than Medea. This is give or take a little bit of soundtrack and give and take some translucent walls, which has been done before and which works very well. It's set in a boarding house. This is a fairly straight reading, as if she thought, well, I don't want to monkey too much with this. You know, in the interval, I was sort of saying, I wonder if the set's going to go on fire or something at the end, if she's going to pull some sort of Carrie Cracknell stroke. But actually, she didn't need to, because the acting and the writing is just so good. It works. It plays.
Let's talk a little bit about how it's staged then. You mentioned the translucent walls there, but you also spoke a little earlier about the staging being perhaps not lending itself so well to the concept of them being in this sort of a cramped bedsit flat. How do you think that comes across on the stage? Do you get a sense for where they are at all?
Yeah, I mean, the set is this sort of shades of blue, shades of muddy blue, if there is such a thing. It's in Hester's flat, and then you see the staircases behind that, and you see the other rooms and the other tenants. You get that sense of her being, I suppose, caged. I think just the sheer size of it maybe takes away from that. There is a beauty to it, which is lovely to look at, but perhaps takes away some of the claustrophobia. These are quibbles, really. It's a great play, very well done. These are very slight cavils.
Well, The Deep Blue Sea is on at the National Theatre until the 21st of September. Next up, we're heading to Trafalgar Studio One for The Spoils. This is a play written by the American actor Jesse Eisenberg, who people may be more familiar with as an on-screen actor. Eisenberg stars in the play, which was an off-Broadway hit over in the US. Dominic, first, set up the premise of the play, and do you think it will be as successful over here?
The successful-wise, yes. I mean, probably not as, because Jesse Eisenberg isn't quite as big a deal. But certainly, when I saw it, it was a matinee. It was full. Clearly, from the ovation he got at the end, most people are there for Jesse Eisenberg, and he's terrific. We'll come to him in a moment. In terms of explaining the plot, well, at first, it feels a bit like a very overextended sitcom. It's set in this New York apartment that Eisenberg's character has been given by his dad. He's got a Nepalese student who lives with him. And really, it just consists of him being this failed wannabe filmmaker graduate, kind of dissing everything around him in a very sort of, modern day New York Jimmy Porter kind of way, except as a spoilt rich kid. But he's sharp, he's clever, he can be nasty. And he's quite exciting to watch. You don't like him particularly. And because Eisenberg is playing him and has written him, you sort of think, oh, well, is he saying we should sympathise with him? But then he writes these three other characters very well who see through this character and see all his foibles and all his flaws. Four other characters, sorry. It's a puzzle. It's an enjoyable evening, and it's a puzzling one. Because you leave it having enjoyed it, having enjoyed the lines, beautifully played. I mean, everyone's tip-top. You believe in everyone. You don't really know what to feel about any of these people. Well, specifically about the Eisenberg character.
It almost feels as though you're talking about The Social Network, which of course was the film in which he played Mark Zuckerberg, the creator of Facebook. He does have a bit of a knack for playing those sorts of characters, doesn't he? But I would have to say, looking at his on-screen career, there are different shades of success. He performed as Mark Zuckerberg wonderfully in that film that did exceptionally well, The Social Network. But then he played an unlikable character in the recent Batman vs. Superman movie. Obviously, that script was atrocious, so didn't help anyone there, but he can perhaps overdo the unlikable aspect, if you were to ask me.
I think he plays the part that he has written perfectly. And I think the question is, how are we supposed to feel about this guy whose flaws we know? And you know, heroes, protagonists don't have to be likable. I don't think that at all. They have to be interesting. He is interesting, but as it goes, and it's a bit long, it's 2.5 hours, which is too long. But you come out sort of thinking, what am I supposed to take away? Yes, he's got some good points which sort of underscore his nastiness, but he is nasty. And I was talking about this afterwards, and I can imagine all sorts of ways in which a script editor could come in and say, well, we need to cut this half an hour, we need to make him more likable or explain something there. And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, it just wouldn't help. It is, I'm not sure it's great art, I'm not even sure it's good art, but I think it is art. There is something gnarly in there. There is something one can't quite explain about it that makes it more than just an overextended sitcom script. And I couldn't tell you why we should care about this guy. I just know that he is interesting. And he is interesting. I'll say no more, but also no less than that about him.
It's sort of, it feels like you're sort of echoing a little while ago when Jesse Eisenberg famously wrote a piece that critiqued all of the critics working out there today.
Right.
So he would probably be quite upset that we're even talking about
yeah.
him on this.
Oh, and fair play to him. He's flummoxed me. He, I don't know how to react. I can report how I felt, but in summing out, it's difficult. If I wouldn't urge anyone to go and see it, but if you do, I think you'll come away with stuff to talk about.
Dominic Maxwell wouldn't urge you to go and see The Spoils, but if you do, it is on at Trafalgar Studio One until August the 13th. Now, finally, we'll finish things off this week all aboard the Titanic. But don't worry, this is not a remake of the James Cameron film. It's actually a production based on some of the real people who were on board the ship. It premiered on Broadway shortly before the film was released back in 1997. And now it's playing at Charing Cross Theatre here in London. Dominic, how do you even begin to put something as huge as the Titanic on stage?
Well, first of all, I would urge you to go and see this one. Get that one in first. God, yeah. They pack it in. They get the officers on. They get representatives of all three classes. And because of that, some of the dialogue, some of the lyrics are quite on the nose. And so to begin with, I thought, nah, this isn't going to cut it. And also, of course, it just seemed like a terrible idea. A Titanic musical. Who, you know, isn't life a bit short? Do we need a Titanic musical? I knew it had got Tonys when it first played on Broadway in 97, 98. I also knew it had closed at a loss. So it seemed a bit like the Titanic itself, like a sort of maybe a big folly. It's magic, though. It is magic. The music by Murray Esten, who I hadn't heard before, he also did the music for Nine, which became a film, is just terrific. There's a touch of, I don't know, Elgar Vaughan Williams in there, but there's also quite a big touch of sort of American minimalists in there, John Adams, Steve Reich, Philip Glass. There's a propulsiveness, there's a percussiveness, there's a beauty to it that keeps this going. And so that's the sort of the ebbing flow of the music keeps it interesting, even as maybe some of the characters you think are a little bit two-dimensional.
Well, that sort of picks up what my thoughts were of Nine, which is interesting that you've compared it to that just there, because I thought the music in Nine was fantastic. The story was just a little bit flabby.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds as though the music has really saved this one as well. Do you still get some sort of fulfillment from the story that's running through it as well, though?
Yeah, I think the story finds its sea legs. You get to accept that, okay, these are going to be sort of bullet point characters. But actually, once you accept that, there is... on the one hand, there is no subtext here. People more or less say what they think.
Mm.
But within the context of the music, which has a sort of strings, keyboard, percussion backing, so it's all very pared down, 260-seater, cast of 20, mind you, which is big. In this context, it all makes sense, and it's operatic, and there is a sort of saying what you mean thing in opera sometimes. It plays, and actually there is real nuance and there is real subtlety in the characterization once you tune into it, and it's very moving. God, who saw this coming?
Well, from what I understand, the focus of the play isn't really on the tragedy, but instead on the class system, and also our obsession with progress as well. It's an interesting metaphor that I think was maybe raised a little bit in the film version that we briefly mentioned just before. Do you think it's actually seeking to say something in some sort of profound way with that sort of metaphorical commentary on the concept of progress?
Yeah. Having said there's no subtext in a way the whole thing is a kind of giant metaphor for human existence, for life itself. When we start out, we have these hopes, these dreams, over-ambitious some of them. You've got to have a go, though. And as it goes on, you see all the, like I say, you've got these snapshots of lives. You see these hopes in the first half expressed. We're going to do this in the new world. We're going to do that in the new world. And we know with dramatic irony, no, you're not, or you're probably not. And then the second half, it is the longest, it's about 45 minutes, the second half, and it's the longest sort of facing up to death and disappointment I've seen in theatre, let alone musical theatre. And yet, again, because of the music and because of the playing, it's sort of beautiful. I mean, I'm sounding a bit gooey about this, but I actually did something I've never, ever done before, which is I came out of it and I got tickets to go and see it again the next day.
Extraordinary. Who would have thought we'd have a happy ending on the Titanic? Well, that is it. Titanic is on at the Charing Cross Theatre until the 6th of August, which brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks very much to my guest today, Dominic Maxwell. You have been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. This show was produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for this week's book review. But for now, goodbye from me, and thanks for listening.